You're listening to Malice After Midnight. The following podcast contains subject matter that may be disturbing to some listeners. The views and opinions expressed are those of the hosts and not of the sponsors. Listener discretion is advised. And now, Malice After Midnight with Tina, Steve, and Christine.
Hello. Today we're going to have one of our, I guess I'll say mini episodes. I don't know exactly how long it's going to be, but first, let's get a little business done. Or I shouldn't say business, but we want to thank everybody that's been following us on Twitter. We're actually getting some pretty good numbers. It's pretty awesome. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, that is what, Tina?
At After Malice.
Or just search Malice After Midnight.
Malice After Midnight.
We also have Instagram. Numbers ain't quite as big on there.
Insta.
But hey, it's getting there. So.
But everyone has a special place.
Yes. So if you want to follow us on Instagram, it is
Malice After Midnight Podcast.
So you can hashtag us, hash brown us.
Hash brown us.
All the hash browns.
All the hash browns.
Give them all.
We also still have that email address. So if you have anything you want to talk to us about or comment, or if you have some cool story in your life that has to do with something that's malice-y,
yeah.
Crime, whatever. Something cool, and you want us to maybe read it on the air, we'll do it. You know, we'll leave your name out of it or put your name in it, whatever you want.
Whatever you want.
Our email address is?
MaliceAfterMidnight@gmail.com.
All right. So, as you know, a couple episodes ago, I did a Ted Bundy episode. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I have issues when it comes to the facts and trying to get all the facts in. And I talked about his first, well, the first case that they thought maybe was related to him, Anne-Marie Burr, the little 8-year-old girl who went missing. Well, I didn't have a whole lot about it in my Ted Bundy episode, so I did a little bit more just on her case. It's not a whole lot, so it's not going to be real long. But so today's episode is going to be on the disappearance of Anne-Marie Burr. Early in the morning on August 31st, 1961, in Tacoma, Washington, 8-year-old Anne-Marie Burr went missing from her family home. It was a normal, all-American Labor Day weekend. Anne-Marie and her younger siblings, Julie, Greg, and Mary, spent most of the day playing outside with neighborhood friends. Anne was invited to sleep over at a friend's house, but her mother, Beverly, wanted her to stay home that night, which I bet that's kind of a decision she probably regretted.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but you don't know.
You don't know.
You don't know, but still. That night, Greg and Julie spent the night in a fort in the basement, and Anne and her little sister Mary spent the night in Anne's room. Anne's parents, Don and Beverly, heard some noises outside that night, so they made sure the house was locked up, except for a living room window that was always left open a crack to let wires for their TV antenna into the house. So for you kids listening, TVs used to have antennas.
Yeah.
An antenna is how they picked up the signal from the radio, I mean from the TV stations, and it went on the airwaves. And you had to have an antenna at your house to actually watch TV. So there you go. No internet.
In the dorm, mm-hmm. we used to have to run the cables over the windows.
Anyway,
just
a little lesson. So they had a window into their living room that was always open to crack because the wires from the antenna mm-hmm. actually came in that window.
That's why my dorm room
which was real common. There was a bad storm that night that left many neighborhoods in the area without power. And when Beverly woke up around 5:15 a.m. to check the children, Julie and Greg were still asleep in the basement. And when she went to check on Anne and Mary, she found Anne's bed empty. She went downstairs and found the living room window wide open, and the chain lock on the front door was undone, such those chains on the inside.
Yeah, that's scary.
Let me say, though,
the front door was open.
They obviously didn't go investigate the noises they heard outside.
Well, they heard, they locked up. I mean, there was a storm. Their dog did bark. They heard their dog bark.
So.
But like I said, it was a bad storm that night. Lots of noises. And my dog barks in the middle of the night, and I don't get up every time.
I do. When my dog barks in the middle of the night, I'm constantly looking out my window. But well, I do listen to
a
lot of this crazy shit.
You know, a lot of stuff's blowing around.
Yeah. Beverly ran to the neighbors' houses to see if they had seen Anne, and of course nobody did.
Yeah. That had to have been just terrifying.
Oh, I couldn't imagine. I remember one time Jennifer, I was outside. And Jennifer came outside, and when I went inside, she wasn't in the house.
Yeah.
And I went outside and we were running around the house trying to find each other. So it was I was like, Jennifer. And I was like, and I ran and I was like, oh my God. And finally I caught up to her running around outside. It scared the crap out of me. So, yeah. So it just in that moment, I really thought she was gone. So that I know the fear. And could you imagine?
Yeah. I couldn't imagine at all.
As Beverly was walking around her house, she saw a stool outside the living room window, the one that was left open. So somebody got on a stool to climb in. And after that, her and her husband called the police.
Well, yeah, because you got to do all the parameters first.
Well, yeah, you got to look first. A lot of times, you don't automatically just think kidnapping. You know, no. Kids go outside and do things, especially in the 60s.
Yeah,
60s
else,
kids played. Anne Marie, she had piano lessons she took. And I remember seeing where she would walk 4 blocks by herself at age 8 to go to piano lessons. I mean, times were different.
We walked to school, and that was early 90s?
For you guys keeping track, that is the second time Christina's mentioned that we walked to school as children.
OMG. Okay.
All right. One thing I should tell you about Tacoma.
Well, you did, so.
Yeah, we did walk to school, but so this is the second episode she brought it up. No, that's cool.
I'm proud of that moment.
Yeah. One thing I should tell you about Tacoma is it was called the kidnap capital of the West.
What in the world?
The crap?
Yes. Now, most of this is because of like some high-profile kidnappings in the 30s. Which this was in the 60s, so about 30 years earlier.
Yeah.
But still, that's quite a moniker.
I don't know if I would be comfortable living there.
Yeah.
No. All I can think of, though, is when you say kidnap capital of the world, all I can think of is the murder capital of the world from Lost Boys.
Yeah.
Santa Clara. That's the first thing that popped into my head.
Yeah, you're right, though. They probably didn't realize that you said it was from the 30s. Who talks about?
People didn't talk back then. But either way. After the police interviewed the Burrs, the search began. Construction sites around the University of Puget Sound were searched. And that's where, one report I read said the police saw this. And one I read said that it was actually Anne Marie's father, Don, and his brother or brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know for sure who saw this or who went to the Puget Sound University first. But
yeah.
That's where they saw a teenage boy standing around kicking dirt and watching the search. And you remember we talked about that in the Ted Bundy episode.
Yeah.
So after Beverly was interviewed by the local Seattle TV station, there was hundreds of police and National Guardsmen out searching for Anne Marie. Oh.
So this was, they were really putting the effort
in. This was actually, and I was going to mention this later, but I'll say it now. This was one of the largest manhunts for Tacoma, like ever. It was a huge manhunt. Yeah. Searching for her, you know.
Too bad it didn't get any fruition because there was so many out there looking. You know, if she was around, you think.
Yeah, well, she was now there. She was never found. Hours, yeah. She's still, it's still a missing persons case.
Wow.
They had areas to search in her. Like I said, there was the University of Puget Sound where there was some construction going on. There was a small orchard in the area, in the neighborhood, close to the Burr home. And there was also open ditches that were about 30 foot deep that were dug for a sewer project that was going on. So plenty of places to hide somebody.
Yeah, really.
Gosh. Mm-hmm. It just seems like so many opportunities out there just piling on and on for her to come up.
Now, the main problem was, though, that they had really no evidence to go on. All they had was there was a footprint on the stool that was used to climb in the window and a red piece of thread stuck to a brick around the window. And that is it.
Oh, wow. And there's not really anything you can do with a thread for real.
And unfortunately, a family member was like trying to help out around the house and actually like cleaned and dusted the house.
Oh my God. Why?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm sorry. Now's not the time to start cleaning and dusting. Please stop.
Yeah. People.
The footprint that was on the stool was rather small. It could have been a young teenage boy or a small adult's foot. Police were able to figure out what type of shoe it was, and it was a common male, like boys or males, tennis shoe of the time. The police did talk to Anne's little sister, Mary, but she didn't remember anything.
Yeah, she probably was asleep. You know, maybe didn't even wake up.
I don't even know if he took her out of the room or if if she came downstairs for some reason.
Maybe
you know?
She came down got some water or something.
Bev and Don said they heard the dog barking, like I said earlier, but they thought, you know, it was because of the storm. They also thought they heard something in the yard a few nights earlier. And there are three witnesses said that they saw a peeping Tom in the neighborhood, but they couldn't identify him because they never saw his face. So, something's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I definitely, if I saw a peeping Tom, I would have informed the police or something.
Well, like, yeah. Things are, like I said, of course, you can keep count of how many times I've said this since I'm making fun of Christine about us walking to school. Mm-hmm. I always say things were different back then. It could be a drinking game.
That's like everybody 20, take a drink. 20 times.
Yeah, but people be like, true. What are you doing? Get out of here. I mean, you know, it was different. It was like.
Yeah. So, but because there was no sign of struggle, the police wondered if Anne possibly knew her kidnapper. Like I said, the police didn't really have much to go on. And one theory was that since there was another Don Burr in the Tacoma area that had money, he was more well off, and had a daughter the same age as Anne-Marie, but her name was Deborah, they thought maybe the kidnapping was supposed to be for that girl. And the kidnappers went to the wrong Burr residence and grabbed the wrong 8-year-old girl.
Yeah, that would make sense.
But no ransom note or anything ever came.
Okay,
so they don't know. That was a theory.
But that's a good theory. And if they got her, I mean, what would they do? Let her go and be like, sorry, you're the wrong. I mean, but.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe, they thought maybe.
If it was a wrong thing, they could have just, you know.
Let her go and say we got the wrong kid.
Yeah, but I mean, why would they?
Well, I guess the other Don Burr wasn't. Speculating. Was never like contacted for ransom. Oh, okay. Nothing either. That was just something they thought. And like I said, this was one of the biggest manhunts in Tacoma history. Thousands of people were questioned and hundreds were given polygraph tests. So they were trying. They were trying hard.
Wow. Yeah, they really tried.
But like I said, there was no physical evidence, no ransom note, and nobody. And, you know, no body, no crime.
Yeah, really.
No murder. No body, no murder in this case.
Especially back then.
No body, no crime.
Now, they had very few suspects, but one suspect was a teenage boy from the neighborhood who had a, I'm going to say, strange relationship with Anne-Marie. In fact, it's described as flirty, which she's 8 and he's 15.
Puke.
Yeah, but I don't really know if anything came of that. I heard one thing where, you know, he was like 15, but there was no kids his age in the neighborhood, so he just played with the younger kids.
Right.
Nothing.
Could be. I mean, if it's
he wasn't, but there was some kind of weird, like, I don't, like, they had, like, pet names for each other, him and her, which is kind of weird. So, I don't know.
Okay. It makes for her to as a young child, you know, to have a crush on him, but as a 15-year-old, the other way.
And I'm also pretty sure his shoe was the right kind of shoe, but that was a very common shoe. I don't know what kind of shoe it was. I'm picturing like a Chuck Taylor type of a shoe, but who knows? That's totally just us throwing that out there. I don't know what the kind of shoe was. Another suspect was actually one of Anne's cousins, who grew up later to become a convicted child molester. You guys are almost in harmony. Like, I wonder. So.
There's just so much. Like.
Yeah, you know. But neither one. They both were cleared, so.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying. All right,
now this one's kind of interesting. It's another suspect. Now, in 1964, a couple years later, an auto parts salesman from Spokane, Washington, became a suspect when he took a 10-year-old girl from Tacoma on a ride around the Pacific Northwest. He dropped her off a few days later, and when the FBI came to his door, he shot himself. And he lived in Portland, Oregon.
Yikes.
So he kidnapped a girl and took her for a drive. I don't know anything else about that, like if he molested her or what. But so that was a possible suspect. Of course, nothing came from that because he's dead. And another one that, to me, sounds kind of interesting, but I don't have a whole lot on this either. In 1965, a prison inmate in Oklahoma wrote the Burr family and said he and a friend took Anne while they were in Tacoma looking for work. In 1967, he was flown to Tacoma, and a crew dug up an area where he said Anne's body was buried, but they never found anything. So, could have been fake, could have been true. I don't know. Like I said, there's not a whole lot.
It is a lot of about that. Weird coincidences. I mean, I know, like, when you are investigating something like that, you have a lot of leads and then they don't pan out or whatever, you know, but I mean, I don't understand people that just confess.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, maybe, I don't
sometimes,
know.
Maybe he just wanted to get out of prison for a while. So they got him out. Maybe. Who knows? I mean, maybe he did it.
Maybe.
They didn't find the body. I don't know.
Maybe it was the wrong spot.
Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the Ted Bundy connection. Like I said in the first episode of our Ted Bundy series, the four-part
thing.
I talked a little bit about this, and I said, you know, I didn't really think that he did it. I still tend to think Bundy didn't do it, but I'm not as submissive about it as I was last time, because I was kind of like,
yeah,
I kind of was just kind of like, nah, you know. But now there's good. If I was the family, I would have wanted to. I would have looked at him.
Oh, okay. Right.
Now, he never did admit to it. Not even when he was in jail. I mean, when he was on death row, he didn't admit to it. When he was specifically asked about it, he wouldn't admit to it. But he did do a couple things that kind of make him sound guilty, and I'm going to mention it.
Oh, really?
When he was on death row, and you remember there was that one special Netflix Ted Bundy tapes?
Yep.
I talked about that. Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't hear this on that, but if I did, I didn't remember hearing it. There was a journalist, Stephen, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Michaud, M-I-C-H-A-U-D, and Hugh Ainsworth. They visited Bundy and got his permission to record him. Now, they never could. This was before he was admitting everything. This was before he didn't have any more chances or stays of execution.
Trying to stall all the time.
Yeah, so this is before he, at this time, he had not admitted anything. They couldn't get Bundy to confess to anything. So they basically kind of got him to start talking about all his crimes in the third person. So they're kind of like, well, what would somebody like this do?
Yeah.
And he said, you know, Ted got real, like he kind of cradled the recorder into his arms and had the mic or whatever, and he just kind of got real dark and started talking about it, you know. And he never would say I. It was always, well, this person would do this and this, you know, that kind of stuff. So he did start talking about, like he said, like this person started following a young girl and killing her in an orchard. So,
an orchard.
Ding, the orchard by the house.
Right.
Okay, he didn't say Emery Burr. He didn't say like an 8-year-old, but that is what got everybody starting to think, because that whole thing in the orchard.
Right.
And supposedly he had said this a couple times to other people. Bundy also told Ronald Holmes, an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Louisville School of Justice Administration, he said in an interview, he stalked, strangled, and sexually mauled his first victim, an 8-year-old girl who mysteriously vanished from her Tacoma home 26 years earlier.
That's
so that's like a just a straight
cut and dry,
up. Yeah. Well, Holmes said that Bundy stashed Anne-Marie's body in a muddy pit near the University of Puget Sound. Now that's, you know, where Bundy first went to school.
Was there. Right.
But, you know, many don't believe this whole account. But Holmes stood by it, like has always stood by that this actually did happen. But a lot of people don't believe this is a real confession. So I put it in here because a lot of people do believe it, but a lot of people don't. So I thought it was still interesting.
So was he on tape saying it?
No.
Oh, this is just
him talking to him.
This guy said this. Gotcha. In fact, he didn't release it till like a year after Bundy told him into some paper or something he did or some study he put. So it's suspect, but it's interesting. And after these accounts had kind of, well, the first one with the one on the tape recording where he talked to a third person, that really did happen. So we know that's real, but he didn't, it wasn't as specific either.
And I wonder if he like really like, because you know he was kind of,
well,
I don't know the word I'm looking for, but you know he would like, maybe he was just playing into it like,
maybe he heard the story, but maybe it was true. He didn't confess to everything. I mean, there was some stuff that, you know, a lot of times killers won't confess to certain things because even they know that it's, like, really horrific. Like, like the Green River Killer, he did necrophilia stuff. Bundy was said, you know, at the end he had confessed some necrophilia stuff. They don't always, the stuff that's, like, really, even they don't want that stuff to come out because they know how bad it is. So, stuff with kids like this, maybe. There's definitely not enough there to tie Bundy to this.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, because obviously that one confession that guy had that was seemed cut and dry must not have been that cut and dry, otherwise you think they would have used it.
Yeah. And he would have said something sooner. Like, I feel like if that was told.
Well, some people think he didn't confess to that, and I said this in the last episode, because it happened around his family home, because, like, another thing, good connection between Bundy and this girl is they lived in the same town.
Yeah.
Not very far from each other. A lot of people think maybe Bundy saw her.
And he would have been right around that age of the teenage boy kicking dirt or whatever.
That they saw,
yeah.
And we know that he did do some Peeping Tom stuff. So
that's what it's called.
You know, there's some circumstantial evidence there. So, but like I said, in the one confession that's recorded, he didn't get real specific. Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean he didn't do it.
Right.
it sure would have been nice. I mean, the problem is you never can trust what he says. I mean, he lied a lot about a lot of stuff. Heck, you know, they're sure it was closer to 100 murders than 30, you know. So, and I would sure think that somebody like him would like to go to their grave knowing they still got it on some people, you know, got it over on some people, you know. So.
Well, it would be nice to think if he did do it, that he could have given the family some closure, you know.
Yeah.
Whether he did it or not.
Or even where she was, so they could find her.
After these accounts had come through, that's when the Burr family started to wonder. And Anne-Marie's mother actually wrote Ted a letter asking, you know, when he was getting close to death row. And I'm going to read that letter to you right now because I think it's worth reading. And then I read it last episode, the Ted Bundy's response. I'm going to read that again also. So here's the letter from Beverly to Ted. Dear Ted, on August 31st, 1961, just before school was to start for you and our children, there came a black rainy night with lots of heavy winds. You were 15 and had been wandering the streets late at night and peeping in windows and taking cars. I feel your first murder was our Anne-Marie Burr. The bench from the backyard was used to climb in the living room. The orchard next door was a dark setting for a murder. What did you do with the tiny body? God can forgive you. With all appeals likely to be refused and soon, there is nothing left for you in this world. There can still be everything good for you in the next. Your life started going wrong somewhere when you were very young. There had to be a lot of bad things happen to make you have your strong feelings of hatred. I came close to ruining my life because of my cruel actions and feeling no sorrow about them. A lot of strange circumstances brought help to me, or I would not have found myself, even though I knew I needed help and my actions were getting out of control. You should have received that same help when you needed it. God can still give the help to you if you can gather together any strength you have left and try to feel a real sorrow inside for the horrors you have brought so many. You will face these horrors alone if there is no chance to be with God after you die. You have nothing more to lose in this world by explaining your sickness. You will feel sorrow and gain everything in the next life. As God promised you and all of us, please try. There isn't much time. I am deeply sorry you did not get help when you needed it. I have not written you until now because the end of life for you did not seem near until now. Will you write back to me regarding Anne-Marie? And now I'm going to read Ted's reply. Dear Beverly, thank you for your letter of May 30th. I can certainly understand you doing everything you can to find your daughter. Unfortunately, you have been misled by what can only be called rumors about me. The best thing I can do for you is to correct these rumors, these falsehoods. First and foremost, I do not know what happened to your daughter, Anne-Marie. I had nothing to do with her disappearance. You said she disappeared August 31st, 1961. At this time, I was a normal 14-year-old boy. I did not wander the streets late at night. I did not steal cars. I had absolutely no desire to harm anyone. I was just an average kid. For your sake, you really must understand this. Again and finally, I did not abduct your daughter. I had nothing to do with her disappearance. If there is still something you wish to ask me about this, please don't hesitate to write again. God bless you and be with you. Peace, Ted.
That letter is such a slap in the face.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's weird. The whole.
God, I mean, he's addressing everything that she's saying
in her letter about the peeping and all that.
And she was, you know, mentioned God several times. So he's like, God bless you. You know, because she's saying, you know, this is your chance to.
Yeah, but still.
But to me, it's very condescending. Like,
yes.
I think he's like, oh, Beverly.
Yeah, really.
You know, I didn't do that. You know, it was just like.
Yeah, but he was. I mean, he did get in trouble for peeping and stealing cars. And he just, in the letter, said that he didn't do this type of thing.
Well, it was rumored he did that. I don't know if there was any proof he did, you know, but.
He was a peeping Ted.
Either way, he was a slime bag. So, after their daughter disappeared, Beverly Burr made sure the story continued to receive news coverage. There were frequent updates in the newspapers. Like around every 6 months and like once a year on the anniversary, but nothing really ever came of it. After that, it's pretty sad. Bev and Don did adopt a baby girl after all this, you know, maybe to fill the void or whatever.
Yeah.
Something kind of interesting is later, trying to think in like the mid 90s or so, Beverly actually received a telephone call from a psychiatrist in Tacoma that had a woman claiming to be Anne-Marie.
Really?
Yeah. And she even had some facts that kind of matched, like having like something about having like a canary or a pet bird or something.
Right.
But when the birds saw her, they knew right away that she wasn't their daughter.
Well, yeah, I bet. I mean, that,
well, I mean, yeah, but that's a lot of years later. It's like 30 years later. It was a lot of years. And I believe one of their children urged them to get a DNA test, and they proved that she wasn't.
Did they do that?
She wasn't their kid. Yeah, they did, and she wasn't. She wasn't their daughter.
So she must. I guess she must have been lost in thought. I mean, you know, maybe she was a lost kid and thought that that
maybe
could be her.
Maybe.
Which I saw. And
there is reports saying that they actually kept pictures of that woman in their family album.
Really?
Yeah. But they didn't know it wasn't their daughter.
Yeah. I saw pictures of little Emery. She was precious.
She was. She was like Shirley Temple.
Yeah,
precious.
We'll post a picture of her on
she
our Instagram
so
account.
So cute.
So cute.
The Don Burr died in 2003 and Beverly Burr died in 2008, which is about like around 20 years or so after Bundy was executed. So they never found any kind of justice or anything. And it's still technically an open case. Nobody's ever been found. It's just it's a missing person. And I mean, by now I'm sure nothing's going to be found. I did say in the first episode of the Bundy series that, they did later use Ted's DNA and tried to see if they could match anything to what was found, but there was really nothing found. So there was no DNA match or anything. So
yeah, you said it's just a string and maybe like a shoe print. Yeah. I mean, how could you?
So, yeah. But they, I guess whatever they had, they checked it for DNA, but they didn't find any kind of match towards Bundy.
No. Well, with all that dusting, you said that. It's just a sad case.
It's a sad case. And, you know, this isn't like a real deep, in-depth story. I like to try to get a lot of facts, and sometimes maybe my stuff's a little long-winded. But I blew over this so fast during the Bundy episode, I just want to kind of to give it a little more respect or whatever towards Anne-Marie, because it's a sad story. And I feel after I did that I kind of maybe brushed it off a little bit too quick, and I wanted to put a little more to it. I still, you know, he could have did it. It's possible. He definitely fits him, but there's nothing to really say he did, you know. I mean, he was even confessing as they were taking him to the chair. He confessed to a couple things. So maybe he would have, you know, did this one. I mean, hey, when you're about to get killed, you're probably reaching for any kind of savior or anything to try to save your soul there at the end. So
that's true.
He would have confessed to it. I don't know. I still don't. I'm definitely not somebody that's saying he did it. He definitely did it.
Right.
Because that kid, that teenage boy from the neighborhood, he said, didn't you say, Tina, that like what were the nicknames? I didn't mention them, but you said it was what? Like he called her?
She was calling him lover boy, and he was calling her his girl.
Mm. Yeah, and he was 15 and she was 8, so something creepy there.
Yeah.
But he was cleared, and he did a polygraph test, didn't he? Did you say he did a polygraph and he failed one and passed one?
Yeah, he failed the first one and he passed the second one.
And there was that
polygraph aren't,
Yeah, and with a kid probably scared to death. I mean,
oh, I'm sure.
How would you pass it? You know, they had their like we said earlier, they had the family member that was later convicted of child molestation as an adult. So there's all kinds of things out there. But
maybe, you know, what if it was innocent? You know, what if they were
maybe
just
she got kidnapped and she was raised by another family and had a good life? Maybe let's hope maybe that was the case, but probably not.
Well, you know, I was looking on the internet with pictures of her and stuff, and there's so many like little newspaper clippings that you can see and stuff. And in one of them, there was like a $5,000 reward
the family put out.
But
I saw that.
It kept growing and growing. So who knows how big that got? But in this one, it said $5,000.
I think in like the '60s, $5,000 was like the equivalent of like $45,000 in today's money.
Oh, I'm sure.
Which is a lot of money. So, but that's all we have on Anne-Marie Burr. I just kind of wanted to give that one a little more of its due. I kind of felt like it needed that. But thank you for listening, and we'll have another episode for you next week. Thanks, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.